This is the Law and the Future of War podcast, brought to you from the University of Queensland Law School. Through conversation with experts in technology, law and military affairs, this series explores how international law regulates new military technologies.
Hi, I'm Simon McKenzie, a research fellow at UQ. All around the world, scientists are exploring different ways of enhancing the performance of humans. The range of possibilities is wide. For a long time, pharmaceuticals have been used to increase the time that people can be awake and concentrating. More recently, scientists have tried to find better ways of connecting living brains with computers, or to allow people to communicate with each other or machines through thought alone. These experiments, which can involve a high level of risk to people and potentially transformative rewards, test existing frameworks of international law. Today, we're going to explore what limits international humanitarian law and human rights law place on these sorts of enhancements and the experiments that bring them into being. To help us, we're joined by Dr. Thibault Moulin. Thibault is a lecturer at the Catholic University of Lyon in France. His research focuses on the regulation of new technologies by international law, in particular cyber operations and human enhancement. He holds a PhD in law from the University of Manchester and a French doctorate from the University of Grenoble Alpes, and was a postdoctoral research fellow at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. Thanks for joining us, Thibault.
Well, hello. Thanks for inviting me. I'm very happy to be with you today.
Excellent. So, Thibault, what do we mean by human enhancement?
Well, human enhancement could be defined as the use of medical techniques to improve capacities beyond what is essential to maintain and recover good health, or beyond normal functioning. Of course, there might be some subjectivity and gray areas in defining what is a good health or what is normal. One can wonder, for instance, if the capacities of the best athletes in the world are normal. One can also wonder if specific criteria like gender or age or ethnic groups need to be taken into account in this assessment, or if plastic surgery should be considered as an enhancement.
So that's, Thibault, a wide range of different kinds of technologies which have different purposes, but is human enhancement a new technological development?
Yeah, good question. The willingness to improve the capacities of humans is actually not a totally new thing. And for instance, British soldiers were given daily alcohol ration during the First World War. However, experimentations to create a super soldier started in a very dark period of history. And I'm going to talk about it again later. In fact, Nazis conducted experimentations on inmates in concentration camps, and they wanted to redefine the limits of human endurance, for instance, by using drugs. Then, and for a long time, apart from that, the use of certain drugs was approved by several armies in the world. For instance, the use of modafinil, which was originally designed for the treatment of narcolepsy, was approved by France and the US and the UK to prevent pilots from falling asleep during long missions. Of course, technologies change, and the use of pharmaceutical products is not the only form of enhancement anymore. The result to surgery may qualify as such. For instance, if LASIK is performed on, on someone who has perfect eyesight.
Yeah, so that it's the point where a therapeutic intervention becomes a kind of enhancement only intervention is perhaps more grey than we would expect on first glance. And I'm sure we'll return to this later in our conversation. But I wondered if you could also speak more directly about what are some of the rewards of human enhancement? So you've spoken about staying awake, but what are scientists or militaries hoping to achieve through enhancing their soldiers? And what are some of the risks of enhancements?
Rewards of human enhancement technologies exist in both the civilian and military spheres. For civilians, human enhancement techniques might be an opportunity for running longer, carrying heavy loads, have better eyesight. For soldiers, mortality in the ranks of the armed forces which result to enhancement devices may decrease. The need for soldiers to be physically sent on the battlefield will be less systematic, as robots or drones may be sent instead. And even if sending soldiers on the battlefield is required, they could be equipped with modern threat detection devices. Then I'm in research on molecules, which would allow quicker wound healing is also carried out. However, as you correctly mentioned, there might be risks. For instance, there are fears that enhancement techniques might be used to change the nature and characteristics of humans. In addition, there are concerns that some techniques, such as genetic engineering, might result in eugenics. And for instance, the selection of babies with specific desired traits. Some experts also fear that it might increase inequalities, as some people might afford enhancement devices, whereas others would not. Then if an army is equipped with brain-computer interfaces and is able to control drones or robots, but the enemy isn't, the battlefield would not look like a video game at all. I mean, drones or robots would fight physical humans, and the opposing army may suffer significant losses. As I mentioned in a paper recently, there may be some more concrete problems, such as the risk of cancer or hemorrhage following the setup of a brain chip. In addition, it is not excluded that brain chips are hacked, thus resulting in significant damage.
There's something very intimate about those kinds of risks. They all kind of get at what it is that makes us human, and there's a visceralness to them, which I think is striking to think about. So the legal regimes haven't been silent on human experimentation and dealing with, I suppose, finding out ways to enhance people's capacities. And so I want to talk about, I guess, the two legal regimes that you've written about, international humanitarian law and international human rights law. So let's begin with international humanitarian law. How does it regulate human enhancement experiments, and why was that regulation put in place?
Yeah, that's a good point. Thank you. There were attempts at preventing abuses on prisoners of war before the Second World War, Provisions about the human treatment of prisoners may be found in the Labour Code or the 1899 and 1907 Hague regulations, as well as the 1929 Geneva Conventions on prisoners of war. However, the events of the Second World War were decisive in the definition of the current legal framework. That is the case for IHL, International Humanitarian Law, and also for IHRL, the International Human Rights Law. For instance, the Nuremberg Code, which contains early ethical guidelines regarding experimentation, was created during the doctor's trials. Well, in the context of the USA versus Brandt case. And owing to the abuses of the Second World War, a specific prohibition on experimentation was required. And neither prisoners of war nor civilians were spared from barbaric experimentations. In particular, a high number of prisoners of war, I mean, from China, Korea, the Soviet Union, or the United States, were subjected to bacteriological experimentations in Japanese camps. And in Europe, civilians, I mean, we all know about that, including Jews, Romanis, and disabled Germans, were subjected to various experimentation. They included exposure to extreme temperatures, to incendiary weapons, well, horrible things. And in accordance with Geneva Convention 3 and 4, prisoners of war and other protected persons should not be subjected to medical and scientific experimentations when they are not justified by their medical treatments. And this protection was reinforced by the first additional protocol to the Geneva Conventions. And accordingly, any medical procedure which is not indicated by the state of health of a person is ruled out, even if a person consents to take part in this medical or scientific experimentation. And in fact, one may doubt that prisoners are in a situation where they can actually consent freely. Well, and then thanks to the second additional protocol, similar protection should be granted to persons detained in the framework of non-international armed conflicts.
So basically the only time that a medical intervention is permissible against a prisoner of war or someone who's detained in a non-international armed conflict is if it serves some therapeutic benefit for that person.
Yeah, that's entirely correct. That must be required by the needs, the health situation of this person, and it must be carried out in the interest of this prisoner. That's entirely correct.
So it's obviously quite a significant limitation, and I think thank you for drawing our attention to the terrible circumstances that led to that really sharp prohibition being put in place. I guess prisoners of war are such an easy population to experiment on if you feel like you need to do experiments.
I mean, the events of the Second World War, explain actually the need for creating and designing these new provisions. So that's actually the start.
So international humanitarian law obviously only applies in situations of armed conflict, but international human rights law applies generally. So how does it regulate experiments on human enhancement And I suppose also if we could think about how this differs from the IHL regulation.
Well, so we have this different frameworks. We have the ICCPR, we have the European Convention on Human Rights, which may or may not have different approaches to experimentations, and they defined two main conditions. They resulted in the definition of two main conditions, which are consent, which is the first condition, which is required for an experimentation to be lawful, and proportionality, which is the adequacy of risk and benefit, which appear, in the ICCPR or the case law of the Human Rights Committee and the European Convention of Human Rights, or the case law of the European Court of Human Rights, or the other instruments that were designed in the framework of the Council of Europe, such as the Oviedo Convention and the Additional Protocol.
So let's unpack these two requirements a little bit more. What's required for consent, and what thresholds need to be passed in order for the law or the court to be satisfied that consents, it's the right sort of consent? And then does that mean that a person can consent to anything? Are there limits on it?
Yeah, thank you. Good question. Consent is the main condition for determining whether an experimentation is lawful or not. And it must be obtained collected for both therapeutic and non-therapeutic research. And this principle first appeared in non-binding instruments, actually. Principle one of the Nuremberg Code, which is not binding, mentioned that the voluntary consent of the human subject is absolutely essential. Free consent was also mentioned in the Declaration of Helsinki, which was drafted by the World Medical Association and is not binding either. But in terms of legal effects, what is actually binding, the principle was eventually mentioned by Article 7 of the ICCPR, which prohibits torture and cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment. And some words were mentioned about free consent, as the provision says that, in particular, no one shall be subjected without his free consent to medical or scientific experimentation. And this respect of free consent actually constitutes evidence, prima facie evidence, of the unlawful character of a given experimentation. And the European Court of Human Rights adopted a similar approach based on Article 3 of the European Convention of Human Rights. Obviously, there may be situations where someone cannot consent. For instance, if the person is unconscious in situation of emergency. And in this situation, it must be determined whether a measure responds to a therapeutic necessity before proceeding with it. So that is for consent. You probably want to hear more about proportionality, I guess.
I do, but just one last thing about consent. What does it require in terms of the information that the person's given? Does it Is there like a threshold of understanding they need to have before they can consent?
Well, that you may find more detailed provisions in domestic laws in terms of information. That's true. We usually refer to the free and informed consent. But Article 7 of the ICCPR did not expressly refer to the type of information that must be given beforehand, and the European Court of Human Rights did not give very detailed guidelines about it. So usually you will find specific provisions, but in domestic legislations.
Interesting. So there's nothing sort of specific about a level of understanding, or it's more just a part of this concept of consent. Well, that's where you'd have to find it in international law. So moving now on to proportionality, what does it mean in this context, and what are we weighing up?
Well, even if someone consents to the experimentation, this does not mean that scientists have the possibility to carry out any type of experimentation. There is a second condition that must be met, which is proportionality, that is to say the adequacy of risk and benefit. And there is a challenge, however, which resides in the different approaches to proportionality adopted by various legal instruments, and they are not homogeneous. In the framework of the ICCPR, there is a difference between therapeutic and non-therapeutic research, and that was defined by the Human Rights Committee. You may find more detailed provisions in the, let's call it the case law of the Human Rights Committee. And therapeutic research is admissible on any subject, provided that the proportionality between risk and benefit is respected. In contrast, non-therapeutic research requires that the subject is not exposed to severe risk. And in addition, non-therapeutic research on minors or incapacitated persons is restricted because they are perceived as more vulnerable. In the framework of the Council of Europe, neither the European Convention of Human Rights nor the European Court of Human Rights referred to proportionality. The Committee of Ministers, the Council of Europe, only recommended that European states adopt legislation respectful of this principle. And two legal instruments have since been adopted, the Convention of Human Rights in Biomedicine, which is known as the Oviedo Convention, and the additional protocol concerning biomedical research. According to the Oviedo Convention, the risk should not be disproportionate to the benefits to the subject or the importance of the aims pursued by the research. According to the additional protocol, where there is no expected benefit to the health of the subject, then this person cannot be exposed to more than acceptable risk and acceptable burden. of course, it seems that the additional protocol is far more protective than the Oviedo Convention, as the lawfulness of the experimentation cannot only be assessed in light of the interest of the research.
So what does severe risk mean in this context? Is it sort of risk of just dying from the therapy, or is it something less than that, or is it something that you can only sort of figure out when you're looking at the specifics of a case?
Well, I see that this criterion of severe risk that was identified by the Human Rights Committee, and the committee affirmed that proportionality, which is a condition for the legality of experimentations, could not be met if the risk to the subject was only assessed against the probable value of the research. And in fact, the interest of the subject himself had to be taken into account. And in the framework of non-therapeutic research, that is to say, research lacking any direct benefit for the subject, the Human Rights Committee drew this red line that research is not proportional if the subject is exposed to severe risk. So, for instance, a healthy person would never consent, I mean, when it comes to human enhancement techniques, to be equipped with a brain check if there is a risk that he or she is paralyzed, because he carry out a surgery on the brain or on the skull. And there would be severe risk if this person might be paralyzed or might die following the experimentation. And obviously, things are very different in the framework of therapeutic research. That is to say, research with an expected benefit for the subject. In fact, a subject may consent to higher risk if the prospects for improving his condition are also higher. And in this context, it would be acceptable for a blind or a disabled person to take part in the same experimentation, to be equipped with this brain chip, same technology, if there is a chance that the lost function is restored. So if there is a chance that he sees or he moves again, then the adequacy between risk and benefit is not the same. It is also conceivable that a given experimentation may have therapeutic benefit for a subject and also have potential for enhancement. However, an experimentation with the sole purpose of enhancing capacities would be considered as non-therapeutic, and this severe risk condition, this red line, would apply.
So just to unpack the idea of direct benefit a little bit more, we're sort of saying a therapy is when you're bringing someone back to some sort of baseline, normal level of functioning, and an enhancement is beyond that. So for a blind person, it would be therapeutic to make them see again. But for a person who wasn't visually impaired, if you were to somehow equip them with infrared vision, that would be an enhancement, even though both are kind of doing the same thing, which is improving someone's vision.
Yes, that's the difference. I mean, it is understood that therapy aims at treating a disease or restoring a lost function, and enhancement goes beyond that. So the same device, I mean, equipping a disabled person with a brain-computer interface, which would allow him to move or talk again, would indeed be considered as therapeutic. But equipping a healthy person with the same technique, the same device, for the purpose of allowing the remote control of a drone or robots would be considered as enhancement, and then the balance between the risk and benefit would not be the same. I mean, it's not exclusive to brain-computer interfaces. I mean, the use of modafinil for the treatment of narcolepsy would be described as therapeutic, whereas the use of the same substance on soldiers or, I mean, before an exam might be of interest for students would be described as enhancement.
I think, demonstrates how the crossover between the categories or the difficulty of figuring where one ends and or where therapy ends and enhancement begins. But let's sort of, I guess, lean into some of these difficult issues. And I think we've started to talk about it, of experimenting on healthy people. When is it permissible to have people that are operating at their baseline? When's it permissible to experiment on them? Is it just crossing the threshold of consent and proportionality, or are there other things at play?
Well, if you apply international law, free consent must obviously be obtained. And again, the question of proportionality is challenging. In the framework of the ICCPR, experimentations on healthy people is permissible as long as a human is not subject to, this red line of severe risk. In the framework of the Oviedo Convention, risk may either be proportional to the personal benefit for the subject or to the importance of the aim pursued by the research. And in general, healthy persons do not have these personal medical benefits. Only in the framework of the Oviedo Convention, only research of importance may justify risk. However, if you look at the additional protocol to the Oviedo Convention, research without that which go beyond acceptable risk or burden cannot be carried out on healthy person, and obviously that is more restrictive. Most states also adopted specific domestic legislations regarding such experimentation, and they often have further requirements. Some of them were mentioned in the Oviedo Convention or the additional protocol, but you may find further requirements in domestic legislations. For instance, most projects involving humans must be approved by ethics committee, and further conditions that may be found there include making sure that the scientific value of the project exists, that the project is relevant, that there is no alternative method to human testing, and this kind of requirements.
So that there's obviously some barriers that need to be crossed there. I think the other one that you wrote about in your paper was soldiers and experimenting on soldiers. And I think there's some of the tensions there are particularly interesting in the enhancements that you give a soldier might save their life in the future. But does that mean that it counts as therapy, or what is it that soldiers can consent to, and what are the circumstances that experiments on them are legally permissible?
Yeah, it's a very interesting point, and thank you for raising it. As usual, I would say it is important to say some words about consent. Because due to the military hierarchy, soldiers are indeed particularly vulnerable to coercion. And I mean, in the 90s, soldiers were deployed in Iraq were, for instance, pressured into receiving doses of an experimental vaccine against anthrax. However, free consent must in any case be collected before submitting soldiers to an experimentation. And in fact, neither Article 7 of the ICCPR nor Article 3 of the ECHR may be derogated from. And they guarantee that free consent is collected before an experimentation. However, and owing to the specificities of their mission, higher degree of risk may be acceptable for soldiers under certain frameworks. In fact, members of the armed forces serve the country and they are supposed to protect national security at the risk of their own lives. However, neither the ICCPR nor the additional protocol to the Oviedo Convention acknowledges the possibility to review the lawfulness of a given experimentation in light of the importance of a mission. This means that a severe risk or the acceptable risk and burden conditions must be complied with. And in fact, higher risk for soldiers would only be acceptable in the framework of the Oviedo Convention, as the risk may be proportionate to the potential benefits of the research. And in fact, if consent may protect soldiers from coercion by the military hierarchy, proportionality may also protect members of the armed forces against themselves, because technologies developed by the army may help them survive on the battlefield, and soldiers may be tempted to take part in risky experimentations. So that is the status of the current regulation when it comes to soldiers.
So it's there's all these interesting things pulling at each other there. You've got the soldiers who they've signed up to give their lives in a way, or risk their lives is probably a better way of phrasing that, for their country, and yet the at least some of the legal regimes and frameworks would prevent them from partaking in experiments that are that might help them on the battlefield. It's sort of an interesting place to end up, but I think the history that you gave us at the beginning of the circumstances that some of these human experiments were carried out in and what can happen when it is unregulated demonstrate why a more cautious approach should be taken. I mean, do you think that the settings of the law are appropriate, having thought about it for a while?
I mean, that's correct. I mean, it might sound a bit paradoxical, because soldiers would not consent to be sent on the battlefield, but they would consent before taking part to an experimentation. I think that there might be risks in changing this framework for the time being. I mean, you may say, soldiers might be paralyzed or be blind as a result of the experimentation, but that may be true too if you send them on the battlefield. I mean, you can be shot and lose your arm. Well, I think that for the time being, I mean, it's better to keep the regulation as it goes. I mean, it's the battlefield and the labs are very different things. I mean, further reflection might be needed, but for the time being, I think it's less risky to keep things as they are.
Great. Well, that's been really, really interesting and a useful overview of this challenging legal topic. Other than your own great article, which we'll link to in the show notes, are there other pieces that you think are great, or other documents or sources that people could read if they wanted to follow up on this topic?
Well, I mean, I'm talking with the University of Queensland. I would refer to, Rainley Vogel literature, of course. There is a very interesting piece, article by either Harrison Dinis and Jan Kleffner on the topic. One of my paper will be published soon in the Journal of Law and Cyber Warfare. So I'm doing my own advertisements here. about the legal review of human enhancement techniques in the framework of Article 36. So yeah, these are potential articles to be read.
They sound all great, and I'll link to them all in the show notes. So that's great and super helpful. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Thibaut.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
This podcast was made by the Law and the Future of War Research Group at the University of Queensland Law School. A full list of episodes and links to additional material, as well as our contact details, are available on our website. Just search for Law and the Future of War. This podcast was recorded on the unceded lands of the Turrbal and Yagara peoples. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present.